All right. Hey, everyone. This is Bram Kanstein, and you're listening to Bitcoin for Millennials. Together with my guests on this podcast, I go on a journey to discover how our current financial system works, why it's flawed, and why Bitcoin is the most relevant technology that you, my fellow millennials, should understand and adopt. In this episode, I'm joined by Mickey Koss. He's a Special Operations Forces veteran and West Point graduate who currently works at the Finance Corps of the U.S. Army. After falling deep down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin in early 2020, he started writing about Bitcoin as a proof of work project. He currently has published over 80 articles on Bitcoin in outlets like Forbes, Bitcoin Magazine, and BitcoinNews.com. I'm happy that he's here. Welcome, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. As I told you before, like I read some of your articles, and I think it's really cool that you know, like you're in a normal job serving, and alongside you're setting your foot into you know, the Bitcoin space, which I think is really cool, especially with your writing. So I thought it would be fun to invite you and have a jam on Bitcoin. But I first wanted to check, like, which generation do you belong to?
I guess I'm a millennial. I was born in early 90s, so I think I'm kind of in the middle or tail end of millennials.
I think you're on the edge, actually. Like I also, it's called Bitcoin for Millennials, but I forgot which years those are. I think you're on the tail end, actually. Yeah, 96 is the last year. So what's your experience of helping our generation understand Bitcoin? Do you find it as hard as I do sometimes?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of apathy, right? And so you know, you had the things in 08 like Occupy Wall Street, and everyone sort of wants to protest everything, but nobody wants to really take action and do anything of sort of substance, right? So, you know, you go sit on Wall Street and you yell about things for what, a week or two, and then it sort of evaporates and nothing happens, nothing changes. But Bitcoin is a protest. But it's a peaceful protest because you're just sort of defunding the system that you find unconscionable or corrupt, and then you're holding your money in a way that can't be devalued. And so it's beneficial to you financially, and it also pulls money from the system that you claim to despise.
Yeah, it's funny, right? Like what I love about Bitcoin and doing the work, right? Like you cannot only talk anymore; you have to walk the walk, right? And as you illustrate here, I think Bitcoin is the perfect example of actually walking the walk. Last week, I recorded with Jeff Booth, and I asked him, like, okay, you know, how do you think Bitcoin is going to develop, etc.? Like, what does the future look like? And he said, well, the future is actually now. Like, you can do the thing right now, you know, like you can move away from the broken system that we all know is broken, right? And some people are just not really ready to accept it yet. But you can do that. You can do this now. You don't really have to wait. Like, there's actually a door to the other side. So yeah, I love that. I love that you say that too, because I didn't really think about it like that before. But it's, I think, more because, yeah, I've just been in Bitcoin for so long that, yeah, I don't really, think like that anymore. But I think it's really important. Like I saw you went down the rabbit hole in 2020, like early 2020. I think you then got it really quickly, to be honest. You know, it's taken me years. I think it's a lot of people that it takes longer than you did. Like what was that experience like, going down that rabbit hole? Like, can you describe what that means for you?
Yeah, so it started out, I was a commander at Fort Hood, and one of my soldiers told me about mining, and so I started diving in. He was actually mining Ethereum, but none of that stuff made any sense to me, but Bitcoin did. And so I sort of went down the rabbit hole, pitched my wife. I was like, hey, we should buy a Bitcoin miner. She's like, no.
Cool.
What the fuck? No. So I went down deeper, dove a little deeper, and I was finally able to convince her to let me buy this. We bought it together, partners, right? Equal partners. So it started as sort of like this cool, like, okay, I can buy a computer and just make money from it. It's sort of like real estate, but a lower entry point. And then COVID happened. Bitcoin crashed from like 8 to 3,000. You know, it was kind of scary because we had just started buying. And then the government started passing trillion-dollar stimulus packages, and so I learned really quick. But it was sort of like a nihilistic approach at first, almost where I'm like, you know, like I get Bitcoin and I understand that it's gonna go up a lot. So if we just ape into it now, we can sell it when it goes up 10 or 100x, and you know, fast forward net worth a couple decades. And but the deeper you go, you know, you start to get that conviction where the price doesn't even really matter anymore. You just need more Bitcoin. And so when I saw that pump, I think it was last week with the ETF fake news, I felt sick, you know. I was like, oh
I
my
don't have
God, I
enough.
don't, you know, you never have enough. You're like everyone's freaking out, like, yeah, Bitcoin's gonna win. I'm like, no, stop. I need it to like stay in this range for just a little bit longer. I need to reach this goal,
It's an
but
interesting
it's
dichotomy of I'm right and damn, or something
yeah.
at the same time.
Yeah, it is. It's like you're happy when it's going up, but you're also like, shit, I wish I had more. But it's great because it's like it's this self-reinforcing positive feedback loop of incentives, right? And so okay, you want to protest the system, you put your money into Bitcoin. Well, you're going to make a shitload of money if you can hold on to it. And so it's beneficial. It's a beneficial productive protest.
And so when you say like the first angle was kind of nihilistic, as in, you know, number go up, we get rich. So what was it that made you like not see the other stuff at that point? Is it just learning as you go, or like were there certain beliefs that you held on to?
I mean, number go up is still important. It's I mean, it's the best marketing tool we have, right? but I think there's two things that come to mind which sort of help me dive deeper into like societal implications and why Bitcoin is so important. And so first one I remember vividly is hearing Brandon Quidham's Pioneer Species thesis and how Bitcoin is monetizing energy at the source and incentivizing infrastructure development in the third world. And so like that is super cool, right? And theoretically, you know, and I've written articles recently where you have Bitcoin miners stepping in Canada and the United States to revitalize areas of the Rust Belt where globalization took away the manufacturing. So now you have high unemployment in areas with too much power. And so, you know, those energy companies have to constantly raise prices on population that can already barely afford to get by. And so it's like societal implications like that. And then just Bitcoin fixing everything, right? And so just tying back all of the problems to monetary debasement. Greg Foss's bond math and debt spiral concept, you know, where it's like, okay, well, if you tie it back, like how often do you think about the Roman Empire? You know what I mean? Like that meme where it's like, okay, as the Roman Empire debased their currency further and further, society sort of fell apart because, you know, you're devaluing human time and you're breaking people's realities, right? And so they can no longer sort of predict or plan for the future, and it just sort of destroys the soul of society. And if we can't print money anymore, then maybe we could preserve that or fix that or at least hold it off for a bit longer.
I think that's already like a pretty deep thing that you went to pretty quickly, but I think this is like especially one of the things when you really go down the rabbit hole. I loved like the whole notion of once you see it, you cannot unsee it, right? Like there's no one. I've not seen anyone who like saw Bitcoin and then was like, no, never mind. Like this is just not a thing. But like the route you're taking, I also find very interesting, especially, you know, I think it's Saif Dinamuss who talks about, you know, long time preference and short time preference, and that that the long time preference is basically stolen from us, especially if you combine it with, like all the debt in America. If you look at the US debt clock, you see that when you are born, you already have $100,000 in debt, which is not something you have to pay, but actually something that is also stolen from you in a sense, right? Like it's money taken from the future that you can no longer have. So even when you're born now, you will have a task of building or getting that value or that wealth back in a sense, but you are totally, the system is working against you. So that's why a lot of people are buying stupid stuff and have this short time preference basically. And then when he talks about, well, when people can actually save their wealth in time and space, right? They can have this long time preference, which that's the thesis then, right? Which leads to more prosperity and peace and collaboration and freedom and all these things. Is that what you also mean when you talk about this?
Yeah. And I mean, that really appealed to me at the start. So I studied economics in college, and we had a little bit of discussion between Keynesian and Austrian schools, but it was mostly Keynesian, right? And they would say, okay, well, risk-free interest rate, how is it risk-free? Because the government could default, right? Isn't that a risk? And they say, well, no, they can just print money. And I was kind of like, what the fuck are you talking
That
about?
makes no sense.
Like, isn't that like stealing? Isn't that terrible? Like, won't printing money like cause inflation? And they're like, no, there's too much demand for dollars. It'll be fine. We'll never get inflation. And it's like that was kind of the first crack, right? Like, you're going through microeconomics and you're doing all these like calculus calculations with these stupid equations, and you're like, okay, I can do the math, but like, where the hell do these equations even come from? Like, you're just estimating things, or you're guessing things, or you're just making things up so I can solve a math problem. And it just, so much of it is just manufactured, right? And
That I find difficult. When people talk about the economy, oh, the beast of inflation and blah blah, like it's coming from something else than another human's mind, basically, right? Like it's an engineered system, and they are also, discharging the flaws, basically. Like if something like as you mentioned, if you ask that, then it's almost like a childish answer, right? Where in another day in this study, as you mentioned, you are doing like crazy calculations, but this answer to that very fundamental question is oversimplistic almost. Like, yeah, don't worry about that or something. That doesn't make sense. It's so crazy.
And so, I
And
mean,
yeah, sorry.
sorry. I guess economics is just, it's just exercise in logical thinking, right? But they try to turn it into a science, and they use the science to justify policies that sort of empower them to make these godlike decisions. And so, in making these godlike decisions and in devaluing the currency, debasing the currency, you are devaluing the value of human time and effort, and you are lowering everyone's time preference to where we, like the stock market trades off of one thing now, right? It's like, is the Fed gonna print more money or not? It's us all one trade, because everything has become so financialized. There's so much moral hazard built into the system that it's all just one big trade.
Yeah, and constantly also, right? Like as you mentioned, like every Fed meeting or every announcement, every publication or whatever, like you have to constantly pay attention to what is happening with the wealth that you have. And for me, that's like feels very risky, right? Like I love that. I love that thought about that. I don't know who mentioned that. I think it's maybe it was Luke Broyles, but he said like, okay, so you have a job or a venture and you take risk, right? Because you choose to do that job or that venture. But then when you're home, your life is still influenced by people you don't know, and they're basically forcing you to take more risk to mitigate the rules and the decisions that they basically make, right? So it's actually very life in general is made more risky. And that's why I personally am into Bitcoin, because I don't like taking that risk, right? Like I see Bitcoin as a non-risk solution to, well, at least trying to protect my wealth, right? And I think a lot of people are not aware of the fact that they are a risk manager next to their job or venture, basically.
Yeah. So the constant devaluation of money makes everyone have to sort of turn into a part-time professional investor in order to just protect themselves and be able to live their lives, right? And so I save in Bitcoin because I am lazy and risk averse. I don't want to save my money in a bunch of stuff with all this, you know, counterparty risk and debasement. It's like, okay, you invest in this company, the Fed decides to hike interest rates 300%, and then the company's out of business. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so these companies can't even plan, you know, several years in advance because they have no idea where interest rates are going to be.
Yeah. So when you say I'm lazy and I don't want to take that risk, like I have the same, and then I immediately think like this should be perfect for any human, right? Because humans are lazy. But I think nowadays it's kind of like I'm lazy, but I also want to become rich quickly, right? And so that's kind of how our society is now shaped. I think people have the wrong the wrong beliefs about money. Like how do you see that? Like how those beliefs shape the current society?
Yeah, I think it ties back into that currency debasement, right? And so one of the reasons why people are so into crypto and is like the same reason so many people buy lottery tickets and gamble, right? Everyone is struggling, and it's becoming harder and harder for the government and institutions to hide the fact that inflation is sort of running away from us, right? The currency debasement has gone too far, but they're going to have to take it even further. And so people are feeling the pain and they're not really sure why or what's going on, but it's causing this sort of societal nihilism, I guess, that attracts people into these get rich quick schemes like crypto, like gambling and like lottery tickets. And because I think a lot of people feel helpless, you know, they've like, I know some people that have saved for years to try to get a house, but you know, Fed prints money, house prices go up 30%. It's like, wait, what are you supposed to do? You know, your savings are getting devalued every couple of years in these accelerating cycles of currency debasement.
Yeah. And so what for you, like, what I like when I talk to Bitcoiners, like you instantly kind of touch upon all these different dimensions that you obviously come across, right? When you go down the rabbit hole, what was like the thing that actually made you see it? Like what dimension for you was like, okay, you know, you started obviously with the mining. Was it then the money printing in COVID where you really saw it?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of like the COVID restrictions and the money printing simultaneously, where, you know, blanket decision was, you know, economies, businesses were destroyed across the entire world, and the government just printed money to sort of stem the bleeding. You know what I mean? But not everybody made it out okay. And so we were in sort of like this quasi Great Depression scenario, but the stock market is just screaming hot. And it's just because of the money printing. And so that happened not that long after I got into it. And it really just sort of solidified my conviction in Bitcoin and sort of precipitated this shift in perspective from Bitcoin being like the get rich quick scheme, like I had kind of initially characterized it at, but to a not get poor slowly scheme.
Yeah. And so do you see Bitcoin as a technology, just a technology, or also as like a philosophy, you know, like I like the idea of, or well, kind of the contradiction of what we just mentioned. Like, if you're lazy, you should actually Bitcoin, but it's not a get-rich-quick thing. You're like, you have to, it's very challenging. right? And you challenge your personal beliefs and your time preference and all these things. So how do you see it, like as a technology, or also like that philosophical part?
I think it's sort of the merge of both, right? If you only view Bitcoin as a technology, you're missing the point entirely. I had a I had this wealth manager in Canada reach out to me who wanted to talk about Bitcoin, and he was gonna, pay me to do some consulting with them. But when I got on the phone, he wanted to talk about blockchain logistics with global shipping industries and stuff. And I'm like, dude, you are so far off. Like, you don't even understand. And so like the technology is just a piece of it, right? The technology is not new, but the combination of the technologies that make up Bitcoin is what makes it strong, right? At the same time, is yes, it is a philosophy as well of upholding individual rights and freedoms, and making sure that individual value is sort of preserved in the face of growing global authoritarianism and increasingly volatile monetary policies. And I guess you can't, in my view, is you can't take Bitcoin as just a technology, but I think to like truly grasp it, you need to dive into the philosophical side as well, because if you don't understand why printing money is sort of immoral, then you're never truly going to grasp Bitcoin.
Yeah. I think that's also like one of the things that I encounter a lot, that just that one thing you just said about, printing money is immoral and changes a lot, changes your situation, even while you're doing the right thing or you're saving for a house, etc. You're still confronted with this external, how do you say that, like external influence into your life that, well, will never stop, will always be there, but you have never thought about it, right? What does that say about the concept of trust? I love how Bitcoin is super transparent, and as I said before, like you have to walk the walk, you cannot just talk, you have to walk the talk. What does it say about our current concept of trust if people are not even shocked by the immorality of this money printing?
I mean, I think they've just been conditioned to accept it. They don't really think about it, and so I do think it's gotten to the point where a lot of people are starting to wake up, because everyone feels like something's wrong and they can't really put their finger on it. You see those pictures, or not pictures, but if you see videos from like TikTok on Twitter pretty
The
frequently, where
groceries and stuff.
Like the groceries, the women crying, like, I can't afford rent, I can't afford this, like, how am I can't afford to live in the city I work in, so I commute for 3 hours a day and I have no life. It's just it's the Cantillon effect. It's inflation, it's the money printing, and it's devaluing everything, and people are I think they're starting to wake up to it, but a lot of people are still resistant.
Yeah, I find it, there's so many paradoxes, right, in the current state, where this is also kind of laziness in a sense, right? Where you think like, and also if I speak for myself, like I've said this multiple times on this podcast, like I think as a millennial in the Western world, I think we grew up in the best time to ever grow up from any person who ever lived, right? And things were just there, they were done for you, everything always worked, electricity, water, housing, like all these things, like they're the whole concept of no one is coming to save you, we didn't really learn, at least if I talk for myself, right? And so I think is the video you talked about the commuting, is that the one that went like viral today, where the girl talks about, this 9 to 5, I cannot do it. I don't know if you saw that one today, but it's like she says the exact same thing, like, I commute for 90 minutes because I cannot afford to live in the city, etc. And you almost see that realization of, damn, like, this is not arranged for me. I have a very big problem, and I kind of recognize that laziness in there, it's not laziness on purpose, but it's just kind of, yeah, it's being unaware, almost, right? I actually also saw a video today of a woman who was like protesting and talking about, I also cannot find a house and I have like study debt and blah, blah, blah. And then there was this guy on TikTok who then went to her Instagram, and then she just went to Bali and like another place, and taking photos for likes on Instagram, etc. So like what do you want? Do you have a problem or not? Like, you cannot consume on one side and then complain on the other side, right? And I it's not really a question in there. It's like more a reflection of where it's so confusing. It's so paradoxical. How people operate right now.
If I've heard millennials value experiences more than a lot of things, and so I think deep down a lot of millennials are deeply nihilistic, and so they spend money on experiences like travel and stuff like that while they're young, because they figure if they save and invest, it's not going to matter anyways. Like, you always hear Social Security in the United States is going to run out by like well before we get to retire. And so I think there's just like this societal malaise built in where people are just, they've gotten to the point where they don't even care to try anymore to a certain extent. Because things have gotten so difficult for them.
But if we then take the leap to Bitcoin, right? If we talk about Bitcoin for millennials, we want to help them discover Bitcoin and adopt it. There is a certain part into being into Bitcoin that is about the self-custody, is about autonomy, is about taking care of what you own, not using a third party to do that for you, right? I try to orange pill my friends from time to time, like, then I throw Bitcoin in again, and I ask them questions like, okay, if you want to get 100K from the bank cash, do you think that's possible? And then they say, well, probably not today, but maybe in 2 days. But that's fine. It's just a nuisance, right? Like, they don't really see it as a problem, where I say, well, my point is that there's a third party between you and that what you own. But they don't really see that as a problem. They think it's all good. Like, how would you approach, well, I almost want to say, teaching people about that autonomy part? Like, you have to be autonomous and to become sovereign, to actually have more freedom, right? And more choices. What's your thought on that?
It's hard to orange pill people who don't care about, like the subject you're talking to, right? And so if they don't care about autonomy, it's hard to sort of orange pill them using the autonomy thing. I guess I'm not really sure how to answer this. It's like some people don't care. Like, my sister doesn't not give a shit about self custody, right? But she has a little bit of GBTC, so it's like, is anything better than nothing, right? And so if someone really doesn't give a shit about the self custody piece, maybe try something like, maybe they care about the environment and you're like, okay, well, these miners are, mitigating methane all over the world. They're sort of developing, energy in Africa and South America and like hydropower, stuff like that. I guess there's no like one surefire way to orange pill somebody. I don't even really try anymore. I just sort of let them know that I'm like the Bitcoin dude, and then, whatever sort of context that they want to ask questions in, I can help guide them.
I think I'm the same currently. Like as I mentioned, I just try again, right, from time to time, but I kind of gave up in some way. Maybe they call when it's 100K and they'll be like, okay, what is this thing? Maybe I need to get in. But yeah, for me, that's also been kind of the struggle also along the way. Like I love these people, right? Like I want to tell them what I've discovered and what I've learned and what I cannot unlearn anymore and what I hope for them as well. But yeah, I fully agree. Like they have to be open to it on one of the dimensions, right? To actually just pull a thread and then just yeah, start going down their own rabbit hole in a sense. So who I also wanted to ask you, like, because of course you also have like an economics background and you learned more about the Keynesian part and the other part. Like who or what has been most influential to in like shaping your views on money and risk and wealth?
I would say Greg Foss and Preston Pysh. I listen, well, I guess Greg doesn't have his own podcast, but I've probably listened to everything Greg's been on. And then Preston Pysh with, like the macro analysis. It might go over some people's heads, but I find his I guess quantitative analysis with sovereign debt and markets really appealing. And then I guess on the philosophical side, I've listened to most of Robert Breedlove's stuff. And so like those I think that's a really interesting way to recontextualize money in a philosophical way.
Yeah, same people for me actually. Mostly Greg. Like I do not have an economics background or a finance background. Actually, hope to get Greg on the pod. We've been DMing, so it would be fun. Like his energy is crazy. But I don't have that background, and I think it's only like maybe four podcasts or something where he's been in. Like he really triggered me to like go deeper down that dimension, basically, right? Like I never learned anything about that, and just like the past 3 years, I've been going down that rabbit hole, and it's just really inspiring. I think also because he's a bit older, like not old, but a bit older than us, and I think even the general like Bitcoin crowd. And I think it's really cool to see that he spent like 30, 35 years in traditional finance and really turned his entire head around, right? Like a 180, and he understands where he's coming from, like what the problems are and all these things, and he now also sees the solution. So for me, that's also very admirable in a sense, right? Because it's really difficult to drop beliefs that you think you have, or drop the things that you thought you learned, and then really like go into the opposite direction. So yeah, cool. You mentioned Greg Foss. Like I love him too. So, and because you do again have this background, like do you when you think about like how Bitcoin could change society and stuff like that, I think a lot about like the current state of like finance and stuff. Like do you think capitalism is like the most ethical system we could follow? Or and like where we are now, is that like the bad part of capitalism, or is it totally not related?
No, I don't think we're in a capitalist society right now. It's like, no, I don't want to say this out loud. So
Okay.
I think capitalism is, do I say this? Is the most moral system. Ayn Rand, so she wrote Atlas Shrugged and a bunch of other stuff, but I think she does a really good job of articulating like why capitalism is a moral system. And it's just everybody is pursuing their own self-interest, and in a collectivist society, people like to talk about greed and self-interest being a bad thing. But if the markets were completely free and everybody is pursuing their own self-interest, It makes society better. That's what built America from, this like backwoods, pioneers fighting Indians in the West to an economic powerhouse, right? It was capitalism. And capitalism is sort of, I mean, not everything's going to be equal, right? But a rising tide lifts all ships. And so there's room in capitalism to take care of the less fortunate through charities and stuff. But if you think about it, like, why do people give to charities right now? It's, maybe a little bit because it makes them feel good. Well, does that mean they're completely altruistic, or are they doing it for selfish reasons because they want to feel good about themselves? Or do they want a giant tax write-off? You know what I mean? And so it's just, it's all self-interest, man. And self-interest makes the world go round, and it's not a bad thing. Buy Bitcoin because you're greedy, and you'll make the network more resilient, and you'll make everyone who also buys Bitcoin better off too.
I love that last part. So, yeah, maybe Bitcoin is in some way also like no, it's not a perfect capitalism, but I do like the reinforcing, as you mentioned, right? Like it's not just for yourself, it's for the collective as well. And I don't really see like any I agree that capitalism is the most ethical system, in concept at least, right? And I love just the simple examples of if we both have a bakery and my breads are better, then more people buy my breads than your breads, and then you figure out, bread baking is not really my thing, and I'm gonna explore something else like that. Yeah, for me, that's just rational sense, right? Like, why would you pursue something that you wouldn't enjoy and you're not good at? And if, as a collective, you're taking care of the collective, then you will also have the space to find that thing where you can genuinely, add value and be good at. So, yeah, in the concept, I also think that capitalism is the best, but currently, when you said about giving to charity, I thought about tax write-off was my first thought. Yeah. And it's again, it's like the walk the talk thing, right? It's not real, it's not altruistic. And I think, especially in Bitcoin, a lot of things are actually very altruistic. Also, yeah, like what you're doing with writing articles, or what I try to do with this podcast, and other people try to do with books and conferences and stuff like that. Like it's to educate and help other people to not only benefit ourselves, but again, also the collective. So yeah, I'm excited to see where that goes. As someone who's spent time in the army and is currently still in the army, like, are you familiar with the software thesis of Jason Lowry?
A little bit. I know it's sort of controversial. And so I've spoken to Jason about it, and essentially it's a lot of people think that, okay, they want the military to like take up Bitcoin mining and sort of nationalize the industry. It's not really that at all from what I've spoken to him about. And so the way I understand it is the United States promoting Bitcoin mining at a national level as a strategic imperative in order to maintain freedom of transaction for the United States. And so it's not like a military branch where like the army is setting up Bitcoin miners. It's more so a policy route where mining is supported in the United States as a strategic imperative for the country's economic livelihood, essentially.
Yeah. And do you have any thoughts on it, or it's just baseline understanding and that's it?
No critiques. I mean, I think any country who is hostile to Bitcoin mining will be regretting it dearly in the next like 5 to 10 years. So, I think Jason, so a lot of people are like, oh, he's not writing for you dummies. He's writing for like generals at the Pentagon, you know?
Yes.
It's like, it's not for you.
Like to clarify, I love it as in love, like how can I, but I thought it was super interesting actually. Like the whole criticizing, I actually, yeah, it's kind of like when they say like, oh, he's a government puppet or something like that. Like, that's kind of where the critique came from. But I think how he builds up, you know, what he's talking about and his reasoning and argumentation, I think was, at least from my point of view, pretty solid. And it makes sense, right? Where in essence, he says there's always power projection, and then he has examples of animals, right? And that, you know, lions go for the wounded zebra and they don't go for the elephant because it is more energy expenditure to get the elephant than the zebra, etc. And so that is just a biological, like something in nature that is always there, also between humans. So war is more normal than peace, basically. So power projection is always there. Right. And that the next frontier after rockets and stuff like that is cyberspace. And so that's where he talks about, you know, defending your own cyberspace through the computer network that is Bitcoin. Right. Yeah, I don't understand the critique, but I wanted to ask you like what your thoughts were. But yeah, like we don't really have to get into it if that's just that. But yeah, I was excited to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, no deep cool. thoughts.
Yeah. Okay, well, then we'll see what comes of it, right? Like, yeah, he was writing it for generals and like a Pentagon briefing and stuff like that. So we'll see if they listen. And why do you think that countries against Bitcoin who are against Bitcoin mining will regret it? Like, what's your thought there?
I mean, at the base level, right? It's just economic growth. So you get the economic growth, you know, the Bitcoiners are going to become probably like the richest population in human history. And on top of that, it's incentivizing energy growth. And so countries that ban or are hostile towards Bitcoin mining are going to miss out on a lot of the positive impacts that Bitcoin mining is going to have on the energy infrastructure. And so in the next like 10, 20, 30 years, I don't think Bitcoin mining will necessarily exist as a standalone business, but rather it'll be integrated into the electrical infrastructure as a grid balancing tool. And so, you know, any country who is hostile is going to miss out on that. And then, you know, they're not going to have a solid economy because they're not going to have reliable power, and power is essential for human flourishing. And so, I mean, at the baseline, that like Bitcoin's impact on power markets and energy efficiency is, you know, it's probably reason enough to leave it alone and let it flourish in the country all by itself.
Yeah. Yeah, I fully agree. I also think that we could actually see that sooner than later. With the current situation in the world and where energy is obviously could be used to put pressure, right, on other countries, like cutting off countries, etc. And of course you also see that in a lot of countries, also my country, like the entire energy grid is not even prepared to facilitate all the like renewable stuff, etc. And you already have examples, especially like in Texas, where the miners actually provide lots of value to keep it stable. So I agree with what you say. I think it could be sooner. Maybe that's kind of also, could also be like the surprise in a sense, like that entire dimension of Bitcoin, which I think is a study by itself almost how to, you know, utilize that, and especially on like a country level. So I also wanted to ask you, as like one of the last questions, you know, if someone asks you what is Bitcoin and why should I care, we kind of like had all these different dimensions, you know, where would you start with answering that question? Or where did you try to start before you?
I guess it depends, right? It depends on who I'm talking to. You know, a lot of times it'd be like Bitcoin is a scam and you shouldn't give a shit. just leave me alone. I'm just kidding. I wouldn't say that. I think if I know them, I'll sort of say something like, like digital gold, right? It's just digital gold that no with an absolute supply cap. But it's hard to answer that without knowing who's asking the question because you could contextualize it in the way that's most important to you and completely turn somebody off from Bitcoin for like the rest of their life, right? And so it's sort of a very high stakes question where when people ask me questions about Bitcoin, I usually answer the question with questions to try to like dial in what they actually care about and what they're sort of looking for. And so with my sister, I'll talk about like I wrote an article about Peru and how it's, helping lift people out of poverty in Peru. Well, her husband is from Peru, right? And so that's sort of like this very personal touch that can appeal to my sister, whereas other people are just, I've had friends that sell their house and they're just sitting on like a pile of cash. They don't know what to do with it. I'm like, well, hey, maybe like put a little bit into Bitcoin. It's savings. It's a long way. It's a long-term savings plan. Or, other people. Yeah, I have family that's criticized the energy industry, and so okay, well, Bitcoin is a way to make renewable energy like more viable in, integrating into the grid. And so it really depends on who's asking the question.
Yeah, great examples. And yeah, I agree. I really try to switch from explaining to asking more questions, but I find it hard because I just love the whole the entire subject, right? So I just start talking and then but yeah, I love that angle, like just ask more questions. All right, so last question I have, and I ask everyone the same thing. What's a core belief that you will never let go?
Trying to think about how to put this. It sort of evolves around family. And so I think with the millennials, like I don't have a ton of friends at work because I have three kids and they don't even have a girlfriend, right? And so with the money printing, you sort of get that nihilistic attitude where people don't look towards the future. They just live in the present and they're going out to bars and drinking stuff every night. And so I think lowering the time preference and putting the focus on family in order to build something that is lasting is sort of a core principle, right? And so I forget who said it, but it's sort of like if you want to change the world, raise good kids.
Yeah, I love that legacy.
Just low time preference, building a legacy.
Love that, man. I fully agree. Thank you. I think that's a great ending. Yeah, where can people find you? You have a nice Twitter name. Well, I'll make sure to link to your articles as well. But yeah, where can people learn more about you and find you online?
I'm on Twitter and LinkedIn. Twitter handle is in the name. It's Plebeius Economus. I gave it about 10 seconds worth of thought. But in my Twitter profile, there's a link tree that has all my author pages and my link to my LinkedIn profile. So feel free to hit me up there if you want.
Also, Ben, I'll make sure to link to everything. And yeah, thanks again for this conversation, and keep in touch.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, it would be amazing if you could rate, review, and subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. It will help us educate more millennials on the importance of Bitcoin. You can follow and connect with me on Twitter. I'm Bram K. That's at BRAMK. And if you are or know someone who has an interesting perspective on Bitcoin that's worth sharing, hit me up. I read and reply to every single message. I appreciate your support and hope you'll be here for the next episode. Thanks for listening. Bye.